Welcome to the Children's Book Author Podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor Page. If you write for children, or it's always been your dream to, you're in the right place. As the Children's Book Author, I'm on a quest to discover everything there is about writing, publishing, and marketing children's books, as well as how to supercharge my creativity, skyrocket my productivity, and absolutely everything else there is to know about how to be the best, so you can be too. Join me as I interview fabulous guests and become the children's book author. So here I am again with another episode of the Children's Book Author Podcast. Today I interview Sean E. Avery, who is, oh my gosh, most amazing writer, creative, illustrator, also art teacher. He makes the best use of his time. And as somebody who, look, I've got a secret dream of one day learning how to illustrate my own books. Notice I say learning how to illustrate my own books because I'm still at completely the learning level. And I called this episode Practice Aggressive Patience, which is a quote that Sean used in our interview, brilliant quote. I thought it was rather funny because I put it in Canva, where I make my little images for the podcast, and I used their magic write, and it changed it to this. I thought you'd find this quite amusing. Nurture a zen-like calmness, but with a fierce determination. Right. I'm not going to use that as the title of the podcast, but I thought that was rather cute. Nurture a zen-like calmness, but with a fierce determination. And then when I put in, give me a more fun version, it said, master the art of aggressive patience. Yeah, I'm going to stick with my original practice aggressive patience, which really is a very interesting way, beautiful way, I think, very creative way, certainly, of saying a little bit at a time, and consistency is the key. And just the things that you'll hear Sean has been able to achieve are mind-blowing. It truly made me think, I could do it. Maybe I really could do it. Illustrate something myself. Hey, if you haven't written anything yet, I think listening to this will make you go, maybe I could do it. Write something little bit at a time. An absolutely fantastic interview. I call it my rolling out the red carpet interview because couldn't believe, like so many others before him, some of the guests that I have been so lucky enough to have on this podcast. And I tell you that it is just such a joy talking to all these incredible, creative people, smart people, oh, just tenacious people. Everybody's got their own flair, their own style, their own way. And I learn from every single one of them. And it gives me great joy to share that with you. You know, running a podcast, well, at this point, is completely an unpaid affair. So I consider it kind of my community service, giving back to myself and others. And in our quest to become children's book authors. And it's such a vibrant industry, very difficult at times because we're not just sitting in a cave writing a book. We're navigating publishing and promotion and branding and our voice and our style and all the internal stuff of, am I good enough? All these things are part of it. And I just grow so much from talking to amazing people like Sean. Okay, I did promise you that if I did come back to you in a few days, that I would let you know what I came up with in terms of how to make a project that you're working on, which may have lost its joy, joyful again. And the way that I tackle such questions, or if I have something that's blocking me or giving me a bit of stress, is I actually go away into my little writing cave and I just sit in silence and I just enjoy the kind of boredom, the silence, the unwinding. I'm not meditating as such. I'm just giving myself permission to unwind and go quiet, to empty myself and just let whatever wants to come in, come in. And then I asked the question. And, you know, the question was, how do I find or create joy around writing The Magician's Academy? Now, of course, I've already written it, but I'm rewriting it and editing it. And, oh, it's so not joyful because it's a 4 or 5 year old project. And perhaps you've done that. Perhaps you've left one of your old series. I hear it from people I mentor quite often. That's, I think, quite a common trip, that you leave something alone for too long, and then when you come back, well, your brain's moved on to the next project and you don't really want to finish it. But I do believe, and Sean says the same thing, he always finishes what he starts. And if not, because, look, The Magicians is actually a series of mine that truly doesn't make me any money, but I want to finish it. And these are the answers that I got back. Now, they might be rubbish, they might not, but this is what I got. Trust that I can bring it together, feel good enough again, rather than worrying I can't do it, because I am quite worried that I can't wrap this series up. It's such a monstrous series because it's the first novel or first middle grade series I wrote. And look, it's kind of crazy. Am I allowed to say it's a bit shitty? I know you're not supposed to put yourself down, but it's just too many characters, too many things going on, too many villains. Oh my gosh, I think there's like four villains. And then if you also include the children of the villains, 4, 5, 6, there's 7 kind of villains roaming around in this novel, which is way too many. But I've got to try to wrap them all together in an interesting way without, you know, having my beta readers, generally my children, go, oh, God, you didn't use that trope, did you? Yes, I often use that trope, the bad trope. Okay, so that's the first one. The second one is to write it somewhere different than usual so it feels a bit more special, so that it's not just, you know, where I always do my creative work. Maybe I actually move it to a different environment. The third thing I got is to watch something on telly that inspires me back into the story. You know, it's about magicians, so maybe I watch a bit of Magicians, Magic, maybe even the series, The Magicians. I know there's a series, The Magicians. I did start watching it years ago but never finished it. So maybe go back into that, start talking about it more, sharing characters, making them fun, even if it's just for myself. Make it my daily priority. I'm getting to that, but first I've got to finish editing podcasts. And nothing else allowed until I'm finished it, when it does become my daily priority. All or nothing kind of gal. So I kind of utilize that energy to get it done, like not allowed to do anything else until it's done. I suppose I didn't write down, but I suppose I could also celebrate in some big, fantastic way when I'm done, like go buy a Ferrari. I won't go buy a Ferrari unless, of course, donations come in for the podcast. I would be very appreciative towards the buying of my Ferrari. Probably wouldn't buy a Ferrari even if I did get those donations, but something to celebrate. So that's what I've come up with. 8 minutes, my intro today, roughly. I'm not going to keep you too long because I'm going to let you jump in to today's podcast. Brilliant episode. Hey, they're all brilliant in their own fantastic way. But perhaps if you want to learn how to draw, but even if you don't, even if you just want to keep writing, this is the interview for you. How to practice aggressive patience. I feel very inspired to be much more consistent in learning how to draw, in continuing to write. And I hope after listening to this, you are too. And go and buy Sean's amazing books. I should probably say that at the end of every podcast episode where I'm interviewing an author. So rewind for every single interview you have ever listened to, go and buy that author's books, because that's one way of supporting them, of reading fantastic books, of adding to the color of your beautiful bookshelf if you get them in paperback or hardback copy, or of filling up your Kindle, because that's what it's for if you read on one of those. Enjoy today's interview, and I'll see you on the next episode. Welcome back to the Children's Book Author Podcast with me, your host, Eleanor Page. And today I have a very special guest. And normally, yes, special is going to be boring, so I choose a fun adjective, and today I have chosen it from the author's book. For those of you that can see, there is the word fabulous, a fabulous guest. It is Sean E. Avery, who is a teacher, a writer, an illustrator, a sculptor, a designer. That's five fingers so far. Born in South Africa, living in Perth, Western Australia. He's the wonderful author of the picture books, Happy as a Hog Out of Mud. Love, love, love that title. All Monkeys Love Bananas. Yes, they definitely do. And Eleanor's Love Bananas too. And Frank's Red Hat. Also, his most recent book, Friendly Bee and Friends, which is his first graphic novel. Can't wait to talk all about it. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hey, Eleanor. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we have battled like things happening wrong online and glitches and time mistakes just to get this interview to you. I am so super excited to have you on. As I was saying, you are red carpet author, so you're allowed to be as late to this podcast as you ever like. Thank you so much for coming to chat with us all.
Oh, it's absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you. I don't feel like a like I deserve the mantle of red carpet author, but that's very kind of you to say. Thank you so much.
Tell me, how does the inspiration come to you for your various books and projects?
Mostly from the kids that I teach at school. So I'm an art teacher at a primary school. This year I'm teaching year two to year six, but in the past I've sort of taught from pre-primary all the way to year six, so all the different year groups. And I keep a pretty keen eye on what they're talking about, what they find funny, what they're reading. And it's pretty much anything that I write, it's for those kids that I teach all the time. So really just a lot of FaceTime teaching kids and doing fun stuff. You know, being the art teacher, my job is pretty much to how much fun can I make this, right? So as much fun as possible, it comes out in the writing. I think hopefully it does anyway. I can't imagine anyone reading any of my books and thinking that my writing's too serious, because it definitely isn't. It's, all about the fun.
Yeah, but I love that. So you've got that sentence in your mind, how fun can I make this? That's brilliant.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. You never, as an art teacher, you will never go wrong with that. It's so funny, people having stories about art teachers being really grumpy or really pedantic or really, and I can't understand that for the life of me. And same with, you know, when it comes to writing, you know, in a picture book or a graphic novel, I try to just jam as much fun in as I can. You know, it's like every single page you sort of meditate on it. Could this be funnier? You know, and that's really what I want to do, is just jam as much fun into it as possible.
So when I was introduced to you and, you know, I read your bio, I went, oh, what? Let's like, wow, what is this art that you make out of CDs? Like, let's start there. It's not books yet.
Okay.
We'll get to all things books. But, you know, given you are an art teacher, how did that all happen? Because it's, oh, my gosh, I don't even have a word for it. Fabulous is one word, but it's beyond anything I've ever seen, to be honest. It's incredible.
Wow, well, thank you. So the CD art, it's something that I did when I first left school and I was at uni, and I was really into building things and sculpture, like junk sculptures. And one day I chopped up a bunch of old discs, music CDs, and I cut them into little shards and I arranged them to make this cat. And I sold this, this was in year 11, and I sold this cat to my school that really liked it. And I kept on doing it through uni and kept on making these funny little bespoke CD sculptures. And then one day Ripley's, I sent them a photo of one of them to Ripley's Believe It or Not, because I thought it might be one of those kind of odd art pieces that they might want to include in their books. And they, when they saw it, they said, oh, this is amazing. We love this. We'd love to have some of these sculptures in our museums, you know, because you've got these Ripley's Believe It or Not museums dotted around the United States and Canada. And so they put in an order for a few of these sculptures, and, you know, they went on display in the Hollywood Museum and the Niagara Falls Museum and a couple of other spots around the States. And then at one point they went viral. I mean, back in, you know, whatever year this was, 2000, I think maybe seven, if things could really go viral. That was really before all social media. But, you know, the Huffington Post picked up the story, and they spoke about it. The New York Times spoke about it. Variety, which was like this Hollywood magazine, spoke about it. So I had all this press around these sculptures, you know. I think because no one had ever, it was kind of at the end of CD and DVD lifespans, you know, and it was kind of at the perfect point where people were sort of saying, what do we do with all these things? And maybe I was the first serious artist that actually did something pretty with them, you know. So they got a lot of airtime, and I got a lot of commissions, and that's sort of how I started working as a professional artist for a few years. And they went on display in lots of different museums around the world, so I'm really lucky. It was a good ride. It was lots of fun. It's the thing with building sculptures, though. You make the thing, you sell it to whoever's commissioned you to do it, and then it's gone forever, you know. And that's why I sort of started leaning into books more, you know, because you make the art, you write and you draw, and then that book you can reproduce for eternity. You know, something, my first book, All Monkeys Love Bananas, which was published in 2012, it's still in print. You know, I think it's in its 11th printing. It's over 100,000 copies sold, and it just keeps going. You know, this little book that I wrote 11 years ago, you know, it's pretty amazing. So that's why the move from sculptures into books as my main art form.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. But going back a little bit still before we get to the books, art. Why art, and how did you learn how to draw so good?
I still don't think I know how to draw so good. It's one of those, I'm not naturally, and this is going to sound really weird, and I say this all the time, people don't believe me, but I'm going to tell you anyway because it's the truth. I'm not naturally artistically talented, but I am quite creative. I'm quite strong in my creativity, which is weird because people think that those are like, they're the same thing. They go hand in hand, but I don't have that natural artistic talent of being able to draw, you know. That it's something that I've had to build up. It's a cumulative skill that now I'm competent enough in my artistic abilities to communicate my ideas in my books. So it's just reps, man. Reps, repetition. You go to the gym, you lift weights, you get bigger muscles, or you draw every day, you are able to draw. I say to everybody that drawing, it's not some innate God-given talent. It is literally just a cumulative skill that has been built with many reps and dedication, just every day drawing something, usually books as well. I don't like drawing for no reason. I'm not the sort of artist that, I know that, you know, I've got friends who make books, and they talk about, you know, they post on social media, oh, I was so excited today, I just got to draw a picture for fun. I'm like, why the heck would you draw a picture for fun? I don't understand that. It's like, if I'm drawing a picture, it's going in a book. You know, it has a purpose, because that's the only way that I'm motivated to draw, is that I know that there's an end point to it. You know, it's part of a collection of whatever, you know, 12 spreads that go into a picture book, or, you know, 152 drawings that go, or 150 drawings that go into a graphic novel. So it's like my drawings are, they've got a very distinct purpose.
I love that you said that, because I feel like my brain ticks the exact same way, and no one has ever said that to me before. So I do actually lie, because I'm learning how to draw, hence why I'm really interested to ask about it. I know all my listeners won't be, but for those of you that are, I'm doing this for you as much as for me. I lie in bed at night and I worry that why am I not drawing for fun, or one of these people that walks around and draws 24/7. And yet I love drawing and I love art, but you're right. I like doing it for a particular project that I'm going to share with the world, so to speak. I get that. I get you, Sean. I get that.
I'm impressed with people who draw for fun, and they probably, you know, they do it, and it brings them great joy and satisfaction. But me, it's got to have that purpose. And that's awesome to hear that you are drawing, because I'm assuming you want to illustrate picture books, right? That's why you're learning how to draw.
I actually want to illustrate chapter books, junior fiction, what we call junior fiction.
Awesome.
Here.
Yeah, in the US, it's often called chapter books. So for both my type of listeners. So, you know, that the illustrated word books that are not picture books, that's what I'm trying to say. But there's so many different styles and techniques. And, you know, I worry that it's not quite professional looking, or I don't know. And I get a bit confused with it all. So any guidance would be really welcome.
Well, for a drawing to communicate, it doesn't have to be complicated. That's the thing. People confuse competency for complexity, right? Mm. It's people think, oh, it has to be very complex. It has to have all these layers, and not at all. I mean, you look at books like maybe Rory Branigan over here. Now, this book is a hit across the world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look at the pictures, right? Very, very competent, beautiful things, like really, really expressive. But I mean, let's be honest here. Anyone could draw like that. You know, they're essentially stick figures, right? Same with someone like Stephen Pastis, mm-hmm. with the Timmy Failure series. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy, you know, he's a world famous cartoonist, but his drawings are very, very, very simple. Anyone could draw like this, you know? So I think and kind of the simplicity of it, I think, is something that maybe a person who might not naturally come to drawing and art, maybe those sort of people are made to do stuff like this, you know, because it's like, okay, so how can I express this in the only way that I know how, you know? I mean, you look at things like Dogman, right? Now, mm-hmm. Dogman is, I know it looks very pretty with all the colors, but if you strip away the colors, the illustration, like the line work, so, so simple, very mm-hmm. simple. And it resonates with kids in such a profound way, because you look at any kid now, if they're into drawing comics, and you know, there's always a few in a classroom, there'll be one or two like working on comics together, you will see Dav Pilkey's influence in there. The simplicity of the style, it actually empowers people kids to think that they can do it themselves. You know, you don't have to do oil paintings to communicate ideas, you know? Sometimes the goofier, the better, in my opinion. So yeah. I think it's something, it's always my advice to writers to learn how to draw. I tell every writer that they just need to pick up a pencil and they need to start drawing. You know, if you do it, and I'm also convinced that it's something that, I don't know why I've locked this in my head, but it takes about 5 years, I think, to be a competent published illustrator, you know, to the point where, yeah, I think that that's what it is. If you do it consistently, and I'm not talking like the occasional, oh, what will I draw today? Maybe you see this advice. It's like, go out into nature and capture what you see. I hate doing that. You know, for me, what inspires me is I will look at something like this and think, okay, can I do that? And try to do something in that style. And ultimately what's going to happen is you'll never be Stephen Pastis. You'll never be Dav Pilkey, but you'll be something else. You know, there'll be all these other influences coming together. So like, that's what inspires me, not going out into nature and drawing a photorealistic tree. I don't really see how that helps, to be honest, if you want to illustrate chapter books or junior fiction.
That's such refreshing advice. Honestly, it's the best I've gotten so far, because everybody has been telling me to go out and draw trees, I feel. You know,
stupid advice.
Yeah, it's like you said, look, that looks simple, but it actually is difficult. Like you say, it does take those years to master the look of that simplicity. But a lot of it, as you say, is trusting your own hands almost, isn't it? Like certain mistakes I make with my line art, I think that's my quirk, actually. It's not a mistake at all. It's the way I like it. It's the way I like that to be.
Yeah, and you'll know if something's funny, because it'll make you laugh. And that's, it's like, ah, that's good. You can tell straight away, you know, if you show someone a drawing and they smile, it's good. It'll work. It'll be effective. You know, it doesn't have to be, definitely doesn't have to be anything crazy for it to work really well.
So did you learn how to draw for your books before you learned how to write, or did they develop side by side for you?
Yeah, I kind of did it at the same time. So I studied graphic design at university. And the focus was on design principles of, you know, making books or whatever. And then you kind of chose a discipline. You were either usually a photographer or an illustrator. And I was never really comfortable at design school pointing cameras at people or things. You know, I felt like a bit of a weirdo carrying a massive DSLR around, you know, and I kind of just, drawing became a necessity for me. You know, I had to design books and I had to have imagery to go with it. So I would just draw whatever, you know, sketch up silly things. And I was inspired by, at the time, artists like Tim Burton, who does these really kind of sketchy, rough, gross sort of little drawings, which I just thought they were awesome. And that's kind of where I pulled out the style for this book over here. You know, these Four Monkeys Love Bananas, my first book, these gross little monkeys with their eyes facing in all different directions and all these sketchy black lines. You know, I thought, you know, I saw Tim's work and I thought, I can do that. And so you just sort of, I just fiddled with it until it looked correct. And this was a uni project, actually. I did this in my third year of uni and my lecturers liked it and said, you should send that to a publisher. And I was like, oh, okay. And I did, and it was immediately picked up. And I was like, huh, there we go. I don't know why people complain about getting published.
Oh, I was
really big for my boots because I thought, oh yeah, like I've heard the crying writer struggling to make their way to publishing, and it wasn't very hard for me. But then after that, the next few years, it was very difficult. You know, it was kind of a weird fluke, that one. And I spent the next 2 years with no books, and then I got a book in, and it sold so badly, my next book, that most of it got squashed into landfill and pulped and turned into Chinese newspapers, my second book. And then I spent 6 years with no more contracts, you know, so I got a taste of the rejection life for sure. But in the beginning, I was like, oh yeah. But I think it's because I didn't really know anything about the industry. I was just happily drawing nonsense and writing what I thought was good. You know, it was in rhyme as well. And I didn't know that rhyme is like leper stuff nowadays. You know, everyone whinges about rhyme. Don't write it unless you're Julia Donaldson or whatever. You know, people get funny about rhymes.
Yeah, they can. But I mean, there's still a massive market for rhyme that happens on Amazon. You know, it's a whole big, giant salesy area, rhyme. I was the same. I was like, people still write rhyme? And I'm like, oh, apparently they do. So, yeah.
Well, look at Scholastic. I mean, they're heavy hitters. They've got Aaron Blabey making Pig the Pug. They've got Matt Cosgrove in there doing Mac the Alpaca and Dharma the Llama. They've got Kate and Joel Temple doing those Bin Chicken books. They've got Beck Young doing things like Speedy Slot. So there's tons of rhyme, you know, and those are like their heaviest. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that sell the most, I think, in Scholastic. You know, those are the ones that everybody knows. So, yeah, there's plenty of scope for rhyme, you know, as long as it's done really well. It's just more obvious if it's not done well. You know, people, yeah, there's just some stories that maybe aren't appropriate for rhyme that you could probably do more clever things if you were just using prose. No, definitely. If you like, and that's the thing, like, it's just do what makes you happy, right? Write what you're comfortable with and what you want to see more of, essentially. All power to you if you want to write rhyme. That's awesome.
So what got you hooked into children's books? Were you already teaching kids and then thought, this is my favorite thing? Or like, why that area?
I wrote this book, my first one, it was a graphic design project, pure and simple. Did not think about kids. I mean, I made it for kids, but it didn't occur to me that I would ever be reading it to children one day. But, you know, it sort of came, and I then realized that once it was out for publication, that you were expected to sort of go and talk at schools, and there was, you know, writers' festivals that wanted you to come. And I was a very introverted person back then. I liked working in a studio on my own stuff. But then, you know, went into schools and started talking to young kids, and I just loved it. I loved it so much. And I thought to myself, because I was a designer at the time, I was working at a mining magazine, you know, just very simple work. I would just block a bit of text, pictures together to make these magazines. It was really long hours, thankless work. And, you know, all of a sudden I was going reading to kids and drawing with kids, and they were so excited, and you got all this energy from them, and you felt. And so I thought, no, this is what I would actually much prefer to do. So I went and did my dip ed, and I got a diploma of education, and I became a teacher from there. So the books introduced me to kids, and then I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And teaching obviously informed my writing, so I just kept on writing too. It's something that I've always had going in the background, because I think it's really important to have use a trendy term, a side hustle. I don't like to think of it as a side hustle, but it's like something, it's your art, right? It's what gives you, you know, that's like you're making stuff. I think it's really important to make things and create in your life, how whatever form that takes, you know, whether you're a carpenter or a musician or a cook, a great cook, you know, you got to make and create. It's really important. I think I would go completely insane if I had to just make. I think I'd become very detached from reality. So teaching is very important to me. It keeps me grounded in reality. But then, you know, the art sort of inspires it. I don't know. It's weird. It's like a kind of a seesaw of one or the other, and it all kind of balances each other out and works together beautifully.
Yeah, it does. I do have a saying on this show that teachers are cheating. So unfair. You have students, you can ask what they like and what's funny. Ah! In fact, I asked my last guest, do you think I should go do my dip ed and become a teacher just so I can ask the kids if they like my books? And he's like, no.
Well, I mean, kids, you read them the dictionary enthusiastically and they will tell you how much they like that, right? It's all about the delivery. No, kids are really kind. I've never got any real harsh feedback from kids. I get harsh feedback from my own child. I've been trying to read her Friendly Bean Friends because she loves graphic novels, right? Which is, she's a 2-year-old, but just loves, I don't know, something about the format she just really enjoys, you know. And she's been really into James Foley's new book, Secret Agent Mole. And I've been trying to read her Friendly Bee, but she's something about it. She just doesn't like the look of it. She goes, no, no bee, no bee. I don't want bee. Want Max Mole. Want Max. I don't even know where I was going with this, but
that's so yeah, funny. So, you know, what inspired you to have a go at doing a graphic novel like this? Like, it's really quite unique. I've not seen a book like this before. I mean, maybe I just haven't been reading widely enough, but there's something quite unique and fun about it for me.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you think so, because the market, I think, it's just exploding at the moment with graphic novelists coming out, because that's where the demand is. You know, it's that Aaron Blaby with The Bad Guys and Dave Pilkey with Dogman has really opened that whole kind of market up for us. And yeah, I mean, so I remember in 2014 picking up a copy of The Bad Guys, and I think there were maybe two books out then, one Aaron Blaby did. And I remember looking at it and reading it and thinking, this is hilarious. You know, I can, and again, it was one of those things, I can draw like this. I could easily draw like this and I could learn how to do this. And I think my sense of humor, it kind of has that, it had this weird sort of anarchic, almost mean with heart, you know, and I really like that. That's what I feel like I had that to offer as well. So I thought, yeah, what, you know, I can do this. This is cool. I think I can contribute in this area of kids lit. That's sort of when I started doing it. So that was in 2014. So I wrote Friendly Bee back then, I think 2014, 2015. So it was a long time ago. It took a while for it to get picked up for publication. It was knocked back by a few publishers, but then I kept on sort of rejigging it, like as my drawings got better over the years, you know, because I think that was maybe the sticking point, was that the drawings were maybe just a little not quite there yet with the beginning. Yeah, with the beginning drafts of that little book. But yeah, and I just love that yellow and black in the printing of the book. It's so bold, you know. It's I know there are other books like that, you know, like Ando's the hot dog series, where there's Pantone spot colors. There's not as much color, you know. It's really restrained with its color compared to Friendly Bee, where it's just so much yellow and black. It's just like, yeah, really, really intense and really, really powerful. I love the print job on that book. I think it works really, really well.
It does. It really, yeah, it's a standout about it. In fact, my kids are 19 and 16. And so, you know, they don't read books like that. But I said, guys, look at this book. And they're like, oh, can I read that? And then my husband literally walked in and said, oh, that looks like my kind of book. And he took it. And I was like, hello.
Cool.
It's my book. But it's, yeah, it's got this real appeal to it because of, I think, the way it's printed. And I really appreciate hearing you say that wrote it and illustrated it and then improved it. Even the illustrations of it, you improved it before it got published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. It needed a lot of work. I think there was, pretty sure it's 5 years. That's the tipping point for people with illustration. That's how long it takes you to become competent, I think. I mean, some people might be able to accelerate that or might take a little longer. But from what I can tell, you know, just from artists that I've watched, you know, because obviously I've been doing this for a while now, just seeing people's journey. And yeah, 5 years seems to be, if you're dedicated to it, of course, you know, you've got to be doing it fairly regularly every day or whatever, you know, just a little bit every day.
It's so good to get that advice because you tend to think that, you know, well, I have this image that you sat down and you drew and wrote this perfect thing and you gave it into the publisher and they said, wow, Sean, we love this. And they published it. And I think, wow, how do some people do that? And why can't I? Because there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes. Let's get into that.
Oh, well, yeah, it's tricky. There's also this weird point with your drawings where they are technically good enough, but there's just something about it that's not quite right. But it's hard to express that to people, to tell them. And same with writing, you know, where you'll have manuscripts where there's nothing technically wrong with them. It's easy to critique a manuscript where there's fundamental issues that you can point to and say, ah, this doesn't work, this is not. But then you've done, I'm sure you've done it before, where you've read people's manuscripts where you're like, oh yeah, there's nothing wrong with this. But then you can't sort of explain why it's not right either. You know, it's kind of, you get to that point. And so it's just pushing past that.
Does a publisher work with you to improve the writing part of your manuscript? Or is it pretty much how you hand it in, they go, great?
I've had minimal changes on my books. There's never been any massive rewrites in the stuff that's been accepted. It's usually been a couple of words here or there. I mean, I'm a bit of an outlier with the way that I submit my books. I generally, like with All Monkeys Love Bananas and Frank's Red Hat and Happy as a Hog Out of Mud, I sent those to publishers and they were completely finished. Like I'd done all the illustrated. I made it the best it could possibly be for me. And that is, you know, and that goes against all traditional advice. The advice is don't illustrate a manuscript completely because it's going to be too complete and it'll put publishers off, you know, because they'll say, okay, well, this person has no wiggle room to change anything. For me, I think that that's quite bad advice. I think that if you are a writer and you want to be the, you know, and you want to illustrate a piece of work, you should just go and do it, you know. It's kind of good. It's like putting your money where your mouth is, because if you are ready to sit there and spend 2 months illustrating or 3 months illustrating something, a manuscript, a picture book, well, you wouldn't do that if you thought it was just, eh, okay. So kind of like for me, it weeds out any junk, you know, because I look at something, I'm like, okay, if this wasn't contracted, would you sit down and illustrate this entire thing now? Would you spend the time on it? And if the answer is yes, then it's good, you know? So I think everybody's, illustrators have to practice, new illustrators, they have to practice. And I think the best way to do it is literally just to go through the process of illustrating a book. Why not? You know, just do it. And if it doesn't work, well, who cares? Then that can just be put in your, you know, people have sketchbooks where they've got all their practice drawings in. Well, you've just, instead of a sketchbook, you've just got a manuscript and you put it away and you do another manuscript and you do another manuscript. And you submit them. Why not? What's the point, you know, of keeping them in a drawer? Just show them to people. And if they like them, awesome. If they don't, well, yeah. I've heard legends of people submitting things and publishers saying, we love the writing here. We hate these drawings. You can't do the drawings because you're not capable. I've heard legends of that happening. I've not met a single person who can tell me who it's happened to. I don't think it's ever happened. You know, I don't know. It's something... I think people should, if you want to draw pictures, you should just make books. Just do it all. Why not?
Such great advice. I've not had any of that sort of advice before. It's a real novelty and great gem because you've, you know, lived and done that and developed yourself to that level of skill. And just, you can tell really that you're an art teacher or a teacher of any description because you're so encouraging of other people to just, you know, go and do it. It's amazing. Thank you.
Oh, it's a wonderful feeling to make something, to be in charge of the whole thing, you know, to not be at the mercy of whoever happens to pick an illustrator for you, because it happens where you look at your pictures and you go, oh, yes, not what you, I mean, not all the time, but it's a wonderful thing to have something that you've been completely in charge of. any feelings in your heart that maybe that's something you would like to do one day, well, then you should just do it. Some people know that they never want to draw pictures, and that's cool. I've met people like that, and you can tell. I reckon there's a huge proportion of people who make books, who write books, who have in the back of their mind that they would like to do it, you know? I mean, Adrian Beck's recently done that with his verbal book. He didn't consider himself an illustrator. He's still kind of, I'm just speaking to him, he's kind of says, oh, I'm just bumbling through it. I don't know what I'm doing, but his drawings are great, you know? And he did it. He just went for it. He never considered himself an illustrator, but obviously that little voice in the back of his head persuaded him in the end.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know. It looks like he's been an illustrator all his life. There's such confidence in those drawings for me when I look at them in those books.
At the end of the day, you know, if you're interested in kid lit, you're reading a lot of books, you're looking at a lot of stuff, you're absorbing huge amounts, you know, huge amounts where you just know and you can tell like what looks good and what doesn't look good. And you can hopefully, if you do something, you'll be able to look at it and see it. Okay, that's not quite where I want it to be yet. You know, you can work it out. Whether you know it or not, you're getting the experience in illustrating just by looking through books. Like that's illustration experience right there. It's just looking at pictures. People don't think it is, but it really is.
It is. And what I love about Friendly Bee and Friends is so much of the comedy is through the interaction of the characters. It's not just like a joke, you know, it's the way that they're interacting is so fun. So, so fun.
That's how I write graphic novels. I start with 2 to 3 really strong characters and I'll let them talk. It's just like that. They just chat to each other. And obviously it helps if they're polar opposites, right? Like Bee and Wasp, one's happy, one's grumpy. You know, there's natural conflict and it just happens. You just got to get out of the way and just let them have their conversation, you know? I don't care about plot, not even a little bit. Comes up naturally as these guys have their little chat. I've always written graphic novels like that. I've got another series coming out next year, 2 books, and another series the year after that. So that's, you know, 5 graphic novels that I've written, and each one has been, I know who my characters are and they're real people. I'm interested in them. I like them. They're entertaining. And it's just that letting them talk, letting them have that conversation. So yeah, it is, especially for a graphic novel, you know, it's dialogue driven. Of course, the conversation's got to be good, right? I don't know. Well, I suppose it can have like action and stuff if you're really good at drawing action scenes or whatever, but I'm not good at drawing any action scenes.
Bit of action going on. I think there is definitely action going on.
I picked flying insects so they wouldn't have any backgrounds because they're just in the sky the whole time. So I don't have to draw backgrounds.
That's so good. So in terms of what you write, what I noticed is you had this amazing sentence in your bio, which is that you're curious, enthusiastic, and ready to work hard for the things that you believe in. Talk to me a bit about that and how what you believe in and what you've been in through in life, what you might even see happen with students at school. How does that all come through in the projects you choose to work on?
I kind of live by this idea that I work in 5 years. I always think in 5 years' time. So it's like in 5 years' time, would you have wished you started today? And that's my lens on the world, right? So at the moment, I made this decision a while ago. I'm going to be learning Japanese because I've always wanted to go live in Japan. So I finally decided I'm going to learn Japanese. You know, same with like the graphic novels. I thought this is an area that I can contribute to. And I thought, you know, at the time, like, this is big. Can I do this? And I thought, you know, is this, you know, in 5 years' time, is this something I wish I started today? And if the answer is yes, then that's just what I go for. I live very, very much like I never want to regret anything. They say that hell is where you get to see the person that you could have been, right? So you die and then there's who you are and then there's who you could have been, you know, whatever form that might be, the person that made no excuses, the person who did the work, the person who went out and got it. And that's what I mean. Like, I work hard for the things that I believe in. Obviously with books and stuff, I believe in books to connect people. Some of the best times I've had with my little girl have been reading her books. The best times I've had with kids in classes have been this mind meld where we've read a good novel together or a good picture book together. And there's just this, anybody who's ever read a book to a kid knows what I'm talking about. It's just this intangible magic, you know, and you can see it, this wonder. It's just it transports people places, you know, And I am in a position where I can contribute to that. And that's something, yeah, that's something that I do believe in strongly, that books help us connect and have shared experiences. You know, we can learn things from books without having to go through crazy ordeals, you know, that some of the people who've written them have, or the fictional characters are experiencing. You learn about friendship, life, love, how to deal with conflict, everything. I mean, I could go on for hours about that. It's important.
It really, really is. So when you decide I'm going to do this project, does it normally follow through, or is there sometimes where you've started something and gone, or are you kind of a finish what you start type person?
Yes, I am a finish what I start person generally. I mean, obviously things change direction sometimes. Stories get reworked or moved around. I usually start what I finish. Just trying to think
finish
if there's anything
start.
That I
finish what you start. I love that you start what I finish. Start what you finish. I love it.
Brain, where is it? Yeah. So no, I mean, I gave up collecting Pokemon cards because that was killing me. It was like so expensive, and it was hard to justify collecting shiny cardboard. So I guess I kind of gave up on that. But no, generally I've stuck with everything that I've said that I'm going to do. It's very, very little. I can't really think of anything.
Where do you fit in the time for it? Like, do you know, they say that as the day goes on, your willpower wanes. How is it that all your willpower doesn't disappear during those school hours?
I draw before school, so I get up fairly early, between 4 and maybe 5:30 at the latest, and I will just go downstairs and do a few push-ups to wake myself up, have a coffee, and I'll start working immediately. I work in 25-minute blocks, so if I can do 25 minutes of uninterrupted work, that is a victory for that day. I practice aggressive patience, where I aggressively attack things that I want to finish. I'm very consistent with things every single day. If I'm doing something, I'm doing it every day, right? I know that the results are going to be years down the track, years, maybe decades. I work very hard on something as hard as I can, but I know it's going to take time. So it's just like these incremental little blocks. You can do anything if you just work on it for 25 minutes a day. There's some statistic actually that I think it's actually 18 minutes, that if you work on something for 18 minutes a day, you'll be in like the top 10% of that discipline or something. It's something ridiculous like that. It's a very small amount of time invested for really, really big results. So yeah, I just make constantly every day. There's not a day I'm not making books, not drawing pictures for books, not writing books, not brainstorming books. I'm always making them, always. It's just cumulative. Just keeps on going.
Mind blown. It's like I got insight from a master. This is things that you just cannot, people will stumble along for years. I think I should almost call this podcast episode, what was it? Aggressive patience. Work at your art with aggressive patience. It's so good.
But it's not outrageous, isn't it? My wife always tells me I'm a bit intense with stuff, but when you cut out the excuses and the, pardon my French, the bullshit, you know, you can find 25 minutes, I reckon, in a day where you can work on something that is very important to you. You should, if you can't find 25 minutes in a day, then you need to do something. You need to, unless you're working in, you know, a cobalt mine in Nicaragua or something where but if you're living in Australia, in this lucky, lucky country, you know, where we have weekends and whatever, you know, if you can just get up a little bit earlier or before you go to bed, you know, if you can just get, and I think the key is just 25 minutes or whatever, but just uninterrupted time. So if you can just cut out, no phone near you, nothing, that would work. And also it could be something that you build up to. I think 25 minutes is ideal. 5 minutes is all you can do. Well, 5 minutes is better than nothing. Here's a friendly bee over here. This is how I wrote Friendly Bee, one page at a time. So I would do a page a day. And after 150 days, I would have a graphic novel. Look at that. It's a mess. It's a scribble. It's a nothing, but it's a skeleton. Mm-hmm. I can build on that, right? It's the hard thing is creating something out of nothing. So that would take, with Friendly Bee, I mean, that was like a 2 minute job. That was just advancing the next step of the dialogue. I'm trying to see if this concept applies to novels as well. So I've started writing a fantasy novel. I'm trying to see if I can write a sentence a day and see how long it takes me to write a fantasy novel. It's quite weird because it's not as casual, because plot is important in a fantasy novel, but apparently, but I don't know if the concept of plot, I know you can do a picture book like that. I know you can do a graphic novel like that. I know you can do a junior fiction like that. You can write a page a day or a sentence a day or whatever. I don't know if it applies to a proper novel. So yeah, we'll see. Even though I'm being very intense about it, I think it's something that everybody can potentially do. It's just, it's not that crazy.
Yeah. And I think what really jumps out at me about it too is I think it's actually perfect what you said. It's aggressive patience, because the aggressive part is you're being consistent and you're working on it. You're not giving up on the process. But then you have this patience because, you know, I heard you say, you know, it's okay to give myself 5 years to become good at that. Whereas I often fall into that, go to write something or go to draw something and I go, oh, what am I thinking? I'm not good at this. And then I don't do it because I've convinced myself I'm not good at it, as though I thought somehow I would just be naturally good at it. And if I'm not, it's not worth pursuing. And I wonder if other people fall into that trap.
Yeah, I think there would be a lot of people that do. I think it just comes down to the misconception that people think too much of writers and illustrators, to be honest. You know, like they walk into a room, everyone's like, oh, the published author. It's like there's nothing particularly special about them. They're just people who have done the boring thing for the longest, right? It is hard, boring, thankless work every day working on your craft. And then one day you're good. There's this mystique about them and they're not that special. They've just been consistent. That's all it is. That's what every single writer, every single illustrator has in common. They've been consistent and they haven't always been good at it. I think a lot of people think that they stink most days. I know I do. I'm trying to thumbnail sketch something at the moment, and these tiny little nothing drawings are driving me crackers, you know, these little, and I'm like finding it so hard, struggling to keep myself sitting in my desk and doing it, you know, and I just, yeah, you just got to have faith because it will, it'll happen 100%. It's a very unlikely scenario where you work consistently on something for years and years and years and don't get better at it. I'd like to meet that person. I'd like to see someone who that has happened to, because I just can't imagine it. It's so alien to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know, I read one time that, true to what you say about doing small amounts every day, that if, for example, you sat down every Saturday and drew for 5 hours or wrote for 5 hours, it does not change your brain to make you better in the same way that doing small amounts every day does. Isn't that so fascinating? Exactly what you're saying.
100%. It is better to do 10 push-ups a day than it is to go to the gym for 3 hours one day and smash your body to bits. You will hate it. You will hate it. People think that they need the freedom to write. If only I had the freedom, you know, if I didn't have the job and the kids and all this, it's like, mate, you don't need freedom. You just need to put your phone down for 10 minutes. That's it. And you need to get up a bit earlier, or you need to go to bed a little bit later. Mm-hmm. There's something somewhere, you know, it's like you don't need more time. You just need more consistency in small bursts. You don't need a day to write. I mean, it would be an amazing luxury, but I don't know. Yeah, you're right. Just that consistency. Don't have to sit down for 5 hours and write. I would hate that. That would drive me crackers if I had to sit in my chair. And there's very, very few times where the perfect combination of, okay, this is my writing day, and also I'm really inspired and they've come together and I'm not sick and I'm not sore and like there's nothing else going on in my life. And there's all these factors coming together to make the perfect day for you to do this extraordinary feat of writing heroism. It's impossible. It doesn't happen. You know, so it's like, do the smallest possible thing every single day, I reckon.
Yeah, amazing, amazing advice. You know, I've had the best time talking to you, and I definitely feel quite transformed because, you know, that last sentence, you've been spying on me, Sean. That's what I'm doing. I'm sitting there going, come on, Muse, where are you? And there's nothing else in my itinerary. And you're right, it doesn't work. In fact, I hear so many people say that they finally quit their day job and now they're going to write full time, and they write less than ever than when they didn't have the time, exactly as you say.
And then they'll take up part-time jobs and do all these little bits and pieces that they hate, and then they're just back to full-time work anyway. So don't do it. Keep doing the job you've been doing for 20 years, because you know what? It's easy. It's easy. It'll give you space in your head. Stop trying to patch together all of these different little gigs, you know, because you feel like you have to be the writer. People always ask me, when are you going to quit teaching? I'm like, I would hate to do that. I'm never doing that. But I'm going to be dead in my art room one day, old man, beard down to the floor. That's where you're going to find me.
Well, I can't wait to see the results of your write a fantasy novel one sentence per day. And I bet it's going to be the best read ever. Can't wait till that one comes out. I'll be looking out for that one, 100%.
Oh, it's garbage at the moment. So, yeah, we'll see.
You'll get it there. I've no doubt in you at all. I'd love to finish up. It's a random thing, but I'd love to finish up talking about, because we, in our first take, we did start talking about this, but in our second take, which is now going to the people listening, we did not. Happy as a Hog Out of Mud. That sounds like such a brilliant book. Love that title. How did you come up with it?
It was a working title that never got changed. It's so funny because I always thought this book needs a better title. This book needs a better title. And then it came to finally, I was drawing the cover and designing the cover. I guess it just is. This is what it is. And it's a strange title for a strange book that I love dearly. A lot of family memorabilia in that book from my parents and grandparents who grew up or lived in South Africa and Zimbabwe and Botswana. So there's all these little, you know, postage marks and all these kind of antique illustrations and patterns and designs that are all African, colonial African inspired. Yeah, it's very unusual book, very unusual title. Love it.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. I'm definitely going to go and check that. Well, I'm going to check them all out, but that one I want to have on my bookshelf, I think. It sounds like a really special one to keep forever. I love books like that, you know, that have that very, very special meaning to the author as yeah. much as, yeah, really special.
Oh, definitely. My dad was so happy that because he's a chronic collector of family stuff, he never throws anything away. So he was so stoked to see some of those old kind of documents and textures and old photos and frames and all those things that he's been hanging on to actually kind of almost immortalized into a little picture book. I think it's good. It was one that I needed to do in that style. I don't know if I'd ever do it again, but it's definitely a really important book to me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I have learned so much from hanging out with you. You are definitely still a red carpet author. I'm not going to change that after talking to you. In fact, I think the red's gotten a bit deeper after talking with you. I'm in absolute awe and, you know, really grateful for your generosity of sharing not just your work, but your processes and your philosophies. You know, these things are literally like gold. So I can't thank you enough for being on the show and sharing all that with me and my listeners.
Well, Eleanor, it's just so lovely of you to actually give us this platform to, because we don't get to talk about it, this kind of stuff, day to day. And, you know, it's a very isolated kind of business, making books for kids. So thank you so much for asking the questions and having the chat with me, because it's good to talk about it. Things I think about and I never get to say. So no, I really appreciate the work that you do. Thank you so much.
Did you find that interview valuable? Great. Now be an awesome human and go and leave a review, because it helps the podcast out so much. Want to read the show notes? Check out thechildrensbookauthorpodcast.com. Want to find out more about me, Eleanor Page? Find me at eleanorpage.com or come and say hello on social at Eleanor Page Books. Until next time, keep writing and keep learning.